Thanks for tuning in for the November 10th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's feature interview focuses on the effect of escitalopram on CSF A-beta-42 levels in healthy older adults. In the other segment, you'll hear a talk on the neural effects of oxytocin on neural activity during social cognition tasks in patients with frontotemporal dementia. Please remember that we offer free CME for each eligible podcast. Simply find the Neurology Podcast episode online and click on the CME quiz link. We offer up to 60 hours of CME for past shows, all available online. It's easy and free for AAN members.
Hi, I'm Jeff Burns from the University of Kansas Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. And I'm with Yvette Chalene from the University of Pennsylvania. Today, we're discussing her study that demonstrated the commonly used antidepressant, escitalopram, influences amyloid levels in the CSF in healthy older adults. Welcome, Yvette.
Hi, Jeff. How are you?
Great. It's great to have you. And your study is very interesting. I'll just kind of briefly summarize it, and then I'd love to hear more from your perspective. But you examined CSF amyloid beta 42 levels in healthy older adults who are treated with different doses of escitalopram, 20 milligrams and 30 milligrams, for different durations of therapy, from 2 weeks to 8 weeks. And you compared these individuals to a placebo group and found evidence that those who were treated with the escitalopram had a reduction in their CSF amyloid compared to the placebo group. So did I summarize that right?
Yeah, you summarized it all for me.
Perfect. Okay, well then give us your high-level summary of the results.
So what we showed was that overall, the people who took SSRIs compared to the placebo had a reduction in amyloid beta. And specifically when we did the post hoc comparisons, looking at the 30 milligrams for 8 weeks and the 20 milligrams for 8 weeks compared to placebo, those differences were the change in a baseline to post-treatment were significant. But when we looked at the two-week group, that was actually not significant. So it seemed that the longer duration was important. I think the important thing is just that this is a potential way of lowering amyloid beta, which would be fantastic if we could make that happen more chronically over time.
Okay, so interesting. So yes, a longer duration therapy was associated with what appears to be driving down amyloid levels. So explain why you were interested in this in the first place, and why did you hypothesize that this SSRI might have...
We might end up talking for a long time because I've actually been working on this for over a decade. And it started with a fortuitous discovery based on a PET study that I was doing where I had hypothesized that older adults with late life depression would have higher amyloid binding. But in fact, the results came in exactly the opposite, significantly so. If it had been just like nothing significant, I would have given up. But since this was, you know, significantly the wrong direction, we then followed up. I got my friend John Cerrito, a colleague at WashU, to do microdialysis studies in mice. And he showed that when you infuse SSRIs and then measure amyloid beta in these mice, you could acutely lower the amyloid beta concentrations. And then at the same time, I was convincing people in the Alzheimer's Center, which I was a member of, to give me access to all of their quite large cohort of cognitively normal controls. And so we called all these people and got their doses and durations of all different kinds of antidepressants. And they had all had PET studies too, since this was WashU. And we then correlated the amount of amyloid binding with the duration and dose of antidepressant they had taken in the past 5 years and showed a significant relationship. So that the more antidepressants you'd taken, the lower the amyloid binding. So that was, of course, retrospective. So retrospective evidence. Meanwhile, John was continuing his mouse studies. We designed a study where we treated the mice with chronic antidepressants, SSRIs, and sacrificed them and showed that they had lower plaque binding in the brain. So about 50% lower plaque binding. So that was kind of cool. And then several years after that, we did an acute study in humans, essentially treating humans like mice and putting indwelling catheters and showing that if you had somebody take a high dose of a escitalopram pill and then sampled their CSF every hour for 36 hours, you could show a fairly significant drop in the amount of amyloid beta 42, so about a 23% drop. So that was the background for setting up this study. And I kind of chickened out in doing the indwelling catheter in older folks. I just thought like, I think I'll do spinal taps. So we did spinal taps instead, which of course dramatically increases the variability, decreases your power, and also, as it turns out, decreased the amount of drop that we could see.
Wow. So a long history that really points to SSRIs, citalopram and escitalopram, may influence amyloid levels. So I have to ask, CSF levels of amyloid are inversely associated with brain amyloid. So higher brain amyloid right. levels associated with lower CSF. And here the SSRI is driving down amyloid levels. And so you could interpret this in a couple different ways, but you're interpreting this as potentially beneficial. Maybe just tell us how you're interpreting these results.
In mouse studies where they've looked at lowering amyloid beta 42 levels, if you do that chronically over time, you can lower the amount of plaque binding. And also, CSF amyloid is in some degree of equilibrium with plaque amyloid. And so, you know, given that we're sort of perturbing things on an intermediate time scale, we are driving the amount of amyloid down, and that potentially would lower the amount of amyloid that's available to go into plaques. So that's how I see it.
Okay. And is it too early for clinical implications? Are there any messages for the practicing clinician from this research?
I think there's hope. So I didn't tell you about the most elegant part of this. So we also teamed up with Jinmu Lee at WashU, who does elegant two-photon microscopy studies. And in his hands, when he follows plaques over time, you can see that the plaques in the treated mice don't grow. They stop. They just stop growing. They don't recede. That would have been nice, but they at least don't grow anymore. So kind of like whatever plaque growth you had stays there, but you don't get more. So that's, to me, sort of the most elegant, interesting part of the studies that we've done. I guess I wouldn't say there's any immediate hope for anything, except that John Cerito has shown that the mechanism is by increasing alpha secretase, and also that the receptors involved are the 5-HT4, 6, and 7. So somebody who can design these molecules could create a super strong 5-HT4, 6, or 7 compound, and then that would give us a better ability to change amyloid beta in humans.
Okay, so more to come. So clearly an interesting avenue of research that may open up new therapeutics focused on amyloid.
Right, or maybe in combination with anti-amyloid drugs, you know?
Right. Well, this is a great study, very interesting study, and thank you and your cat for discussing it with
us today. You saw a little cat action there, huh?
Yes, we're all working from home these days, and yeah. So everybody check out Dr. Shaleen's article in this week's issue of Neurology.
Great. Thank you, Jeff.
This is Stacey Clardy, and today I'm speaking with Elizabeth Finger from the Department of Clinical Neurological Sciences at the Schulich School of Medicine and Dentistry at the University of Western Ontario. We're talking about her work studying oxytocin in frontotemporal dementia. The paper's online now, and the title is The Neural Effects of Oxytocin and Mimicry in Frontotemporal Dementia. Thanks for joining us, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth, when I first looked at the title, I'll admit it gave me pause. I think clinically, maybe it's just me, but perhaps some other people think of oxytocin more commonly as the hormone associated with labor and childbirth, or, you know, the Pitocin sort of equivalent. But there is a whole literature surrounding the effects of oxytocin on the brain, correct? Can you give us a brief summary of that?
Absolutely. Similarly, when I was in med school, we only talked about oxytocin on the OBGYN rotation. But beginning in the early 1990s, researchers began studying social behavior in a model using prairie voles. And interestingly, they found that administering oxytocin or manipulating it in different ways manipulated the social behavior that they were seeing between the voles. So from that, it was understood that oxytocin is highly conserved across species. And so those early findings in the prairie voles really launched a wave of research into the possible effects of oxytocin in the human brain. So over the past, I guess that's 30 years now, the field has discovered a lot of things. And largely, findings converge on oxytocin's role as modulating different aspects of social behavior, in particular, what we might think of as affiliative or pro-social behaviors. And in other animal species, this can be nest building or pair bonding. And in humans, we see effects on activities related to cooperation, to trust, and retention of some forms of social information. Newer models have tried to tie together oxytocin's roles or functions in a way that we can understand what it's doing in the brain. And some of those current models propose that oxytocin may impact these behaviors by increasing the representation or the salience of signals, particularly from social stimuli, and in doing so, heighten our attention towards them. Another model, which could complement the first one, is that oxytocin appears in some ways to reduce stress and possibly reduce processing of threat cues, which could also promote kind of pro-social or affiliative behaviors.
So with that in mind, these changes that it might have in our behaviors and our interactions, I think many of our listeners are familiar enough with frontotemporal dementia, even though the majority of us are not cognitive behavioral neurologists, to know that one of the most distressing symptoms of frontotemporal dementia or FTD is the progressive loss of empathy and, you know, what close family members and caregivers consider meaningful interactions in some cases. This is just so challenging for families and caregivers. But most of us don't actually know the basic science behind why empathy is so affected in this condition. Can you tell us what is known pathophysiologically about the loss of empathy in FTD?
Sure. So, you know, I think most of us experience empathy as something automatic, fortunately. Kind of formally in cognitive neuroscience and social neuroscience, we think of empathy as when you experience an emotional response that's similar or akin to another individual's, and it's based on your understanding of their emotional state. And one way that humans do this is that we recognize others' emotional states by processing their facial expressions and their emotional expressions. So in humans, when we see someone else's facial expression, our face makes micro movements that we wouldn't necessarily even detect that imitate or mimic the same expression we're seeing. And at the same time in the brain, you see activation of two pretty cool networks. The first is what we might think of as a mirror network or a simulation network. And this tends to involve hubs in the inferior frontal gyrus and in the insula that's activated when we are observing someone else's actions. And this is thought to be important in learning. A second network is activated when we're watching these emotional facial expressions, and that's regions of the limbic system. And in particular, the regions that activate when we're seeing someone else's expression are the same as if we were experiencing that emotion primarily ourselves. So it's like our brains put us in the activation pattern into that other person's shoes. Unfortunately, in contrast, in patients with frontotemporal dementia, they have deficits in a lot of these components of empathy. So first, we know they're impaired in recognizing emotional facial expressions, especially ones of sadness or fear or anger, even though they can accurately describe the other visual features of a face. So they can accurately identify the width of the nose, length of the hair, even the gender. They also show reduced automatic imitation of others' expressions. And families, as you may know, will frequently describe that they always look flat or blunted. They don't see any emotion in the patient's face. At the brain level, our patients with frontotemporal dementia, as you might expect, do not show the normal activation patterns in those limbic regions that are normally triggered by viewing someone else's facial expression. And so with that model of empathy and that understanding that these regions are affected early in FTD, it's not surprising that they fail to comfort their grandchild who perhaps fell and scraped their knee, or no longer ask their spouse who might be upset about something, what's the matter? Because they're not getting that fundamental initial processing and coding of that other person's expression, and they're not feeling it in their brains themselves.
Okay, so understanding more now with that explanation about the central nervous system effects of oxytocin and the processing abnormalities related to the lack of empathy in FTD, I think I can begin to understand the rationale for this study. And the study really was just wonderfully elegant in its design. Can you walk us through what you did to study the effect of oxytocin in FTD?
Absolutely. The goal of our study was to see if we could augment the brain activity or activation in that mirror system and in those limbic regions of the brain in patients with frontotemporal dementia using either oxytocin or instructed mimicry, where we told the patients to imitate or make the same facial expressions that they were viewing in an actor as they were watching a movie. Frontotemporal dementia, as the audience will know, is a heterogeneous disease in terms of the combination of symptoms any one particular patient has, as well as in the regions where their atrophy is most severe. So because of that heterogeneity, we used a crossover design so that each patient served as their own control. In the first session, the patients received intranasal oxytocin or placebo, a saline nasal spray. And afterwards, they completed a functional MRI scan while they viewed those videos of emotional facial expressions. And they were instructed in some trials to just simply view the video. And in other trials, they were instructed to imitate the same facial movements that they saw on the screen. In a separate session a few weeks later, they received the opposite treatment, either placebo or oxytocin, and completed the same procedures. So with that study, we found that both oxytocin and mimicry of the facial expressions increased the bold signal detected by fMRI in limbic regions of the brain, as well as in those mirror network regions, the insula and inferior frontal gyrus, in comparison to when those same patients received placebo or when they were just viewing the conditions. And we consider these findings to tell us that these brain regions and networks that are affected early on in the neurodegeneration of FTD and that we think are critical hubs in the loss of empathy in these patients, that these regions still have some latent capacity or some untapped potential to increase their activity with either or both of these two approaches.
Wow. So very sort of quick. I imagine the half-life was pretty quick. Did you see any side effects or did patients tell you of anything unanticipated?
Not in this study. Here they received one dose about 45 minutes before they went into the scanner. And while we did ask about effects afterwards, there were none reported with that single dose. We had done a prior study where participants and patients with FTD received a week worth of sprays twice daily. And there were no significant adverse effects or side effects that were concerning.
Okay, wow. This is really interesting as, you know, I'm thinking immediately of the potential treatment ramifications. And I imagine you're continuing to study that. Is that correct?
That's right. Yep. So, you know, with these findings, we consider this some supportive proof of concept evidence that our patients may have the capacity via either of this pharmacologic approach or the behavioral approach to boost brain activity. And hopefully that would translate into more empathic behaviors and restored social interactions. So the key next step, of course, then is to see, does this affect their real world behavior? And we are doing that right now with a phase 2 multi-centered clinical trial of oxytocin, specifically looking at its effects perhaps on empathy and social apathy in patients with FTD. The study is enrolling now in 11 sites across the US and Canada, and it hopefully will determine whether or not these changes that we found in the study here will actually translate into improvement in the symptoms in the real lives of patients every day.
Wow, I cannot wait to hear about that. We'll have to have you back after that trial's concluded. My mind's already going to other conditions. Can you foresee this in, you know, things like conduct disorder or antisocial personality disorder? Do you know anything about the role of oxytocin in those disorders or other conditions where a lack of empathy seems to be a prominent feature?
Yeah, great question. And for sure, you know, one that many in these fields are thinking about. With respect to conduct disorder and antisocial personality disorder, where, you know, certainly a significant subset of those individuals have empathy deficits, there have only been a very small number of studies that have administered oxytocin, and the results so far are mixed. So some studies showing perhaps some benefit in either emotion recognition tasks or reports of behaviors. However, amongst this small number of studies, others have seen some increase in aggression. And so I think the field is proceeding very cautiously. There are a lot of things about oxytocin that need to be worked out still, such as, you know, are the effects the same across all individuals? Are there differences depending on what polymorphism you have in your oxytocin receptor? Or certainly, you know, a myriad of other complex genetic, biological, and cultural contexts.
That's a great point, right? And of course, all of these things don't occur in a vacuum, right? And so empathy does, as you point out, occur within a contextual environment. So we can't fail to recognize that, I'm sure. So it is being looked at, is what I hear you say, but cautiously. What do you think is next in your specific field? I know you're doing the trial. Anything else on the horizon?
For frontotemporal dementia, I think certainly with that trial, we hope to answer a few important questions in addition to looking at real-world efficacy. If you look at the body of studies in oxytocin across disorders, and in particular, say, in autism and schizophrenia, a lot of the beneficial effects that have been seen and replicated after an acute dose of oxytocin, so a single dose or so, have not reliably replicated with chronic dosing. And so some of the basic animal researchers went back and compared in animal models and found the same thing, that acute effects often differed from chronic effects. And there seemed to be certainly rapid changes in receptor expression and probably other adaptations that mean that we cannot automatically assume findings from a single dose study will translate into a clinical trial. So I think for much of the field, it's now trying to design clinical trials, hopefully, that can address those particularities around pharmacokinetics and the response to chronic dosing.
This is fascinating. Elizabeth, I appreciate you taking the time to give us this primer on oxytocin, how it relates to FTD, potentially other conditions, and how the two might merge in our clinic. The implications for treatment approaches in the clinic are exciting. I can't wait to hear how the trial turns out. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stacy, and look forward to hopefully sharing our next results before too long.
Please take a look at this week's issue. Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.